Everybody still awake? Great. Instead of laughing this time, I think we'll try crying. Would that keep everybody awake a little bit more? Who's a good crier? Got a girl in here that's a good crier? Yeah. Anybody want to lead us in a session of crying? So thankful to be with you all today. I'm going to try to finish this in an appropriate amount of time. And then we'll have a period of question and answer. We'll probably have a short break after this session, then maybe about 30 minutes to have questions and answers. If you have that little sheet in your folder and you haven't, maybe you've thought of a question but you haven't written it out yet, go ahead and if something comes to mind while I'm talking even, go ahead and write that out. We'll collect those up at the end of this session. I've got a couple already, but I think there may be more questions than what have been turned in so far. Well, the topic right now is the illusion that drinking alcohol is harmless. And I realize in the group that I'm talking to, some of you who have gone to college realize that in college, that's the illusion. That's everybody drinks. Andrew was talking about it in his talk last night. You know, they go down to Dolphin Island or whatever, and it's just sort of the expectation that guys are going to go out and get hammered. But in high school, it's not so big a deal usually, depending on what high school you're going to. So you have this, this split between probably the group here, those that are still in high school, and you think, well, drinking's not a huge temptation. Maybe some people do it and all of that sort of thing. But once you get into college, then it's all over the place. But in our culture generally, there's this very prevalent concept that it's not going to hurt you to drink a little. In fact, most people think it's not going to hurt you to drink a lot. It's a good thing to do, according to the world that we live in today. Some of you have heard me preach most of this lesson before, either here at Eastside or in a gospel meeting somewhere. And I say that just first of all to let you know that I realize I'm preaching a lesson I preached before, in case you think I'm just getting old and forget what lessons I preached. And secondly, I'm not apologizing for it, because I think it's such a huge problem, and the idea that drinking alcohol is okay and it's not going to hurt you is so prevalent, especially among young people, that I think I almost need to preach on it every month. So I'm not apologizing at all, because you all need to hear this. And we need to get it in our heads that drinking is not okay, that it's extraordinarily harmful to us. The reality is that drinking leads to a lot of physical, social, family, and spiritual problems. It deceives the user into thinking his problems are going to go away, but they do not. Wine is a mocker and strong drink is a brawler, and whoever is led astray by them is not wise, Proverbs 20 and verse 1 says. Doesn't solve problems. It only creates problems. It is addictive and enslaving, and it results in serious character flaws. Everybody turn over your Bibles to Isaiah chapter 5 and notice Isaiah 5 verses 11 and 12 with me. Woe to those who rise early in the morning that they may follow intoxicating drink, who continue until night till wine inflames them. The harp and the strings, the tambourine, the flute, the wine are in their feasts, but they do not regard the work of the Lord nor consider the operation of his hands. Here are people who are given over to the pleasure of drinking, and it just drives out spirituality from them. You see, drinking and spirituality are polar opposites. They're the exact opposite thing. In the book of Ephesians, Paul will say in chapter 5, be not drunk with wine, but be filled with the Spirit. Those are opposite ends of the earth. Don't be drunk with wine, be filled with the Spirit. Drinking drives out spirituality. People who drink, they don't think about God. That's what this passage is saying. And if you go on down in verses 21 and following, woe to those who are wise in their own eyes and prudent in their sight. Woe to men mighty at drinking wine. Woe to men valiant for mixing intoxicating drink, who justify the wicked for a bribe and take away justice from the righteous man. And so the idea of drinking and losing your sense of morality and right and wrong is plainly stated in a passage like this and in a lot of other places in Scripture. While drinking is accepted in the world, it's one of those things, as we'll see in First Peter chapter 4, a little later in the lesson, that the Christian has to put away. You have to leave behind. It's a worldly thing. It's accepted in the world, but it cannot be accepted and practiced by Christians. And so, this afternoon, we need a reality check. Most of the time, if you talk about drinking in today's society, the only time you're going to ever get anybody to say anything bad about drinking is in the context of drinking and driving. Otherwise, it's perfectly great. That's the way our culture puts it out there for us. Acceptance of drinking is ingrained in us almost at every turn. It's made to look enjoyable in advertisements, in television, in movies. I was impressed with the fact in Gary's lecture out here about pornography. It's a $13 billion industry. That's a lot of money spent on pornography. There is $2 billion spent every year in America just on advertising alcohol. Just on advertising. $2 billion, you know, we were talking about last night about, you know, if you had $1 million, how much money is $1 million? Oh, wow. $2 billion is $2,000 million. That's how much money is spent by the devil in this country every year to get you to think that drinking alcohol is normal, it's okay, it's a fun thing to do. That's not going to hurt you. So that's the prevalent concept in our culture. That's the prevalent concept in society. We're told in the commercials, you ever seen the commercial, drink responsibly at the end of the commercial? How many have heard that at the end of the commercial, drink responsibly? Let me ask you something. You think it's possible to drink responsibly all the time? Do you know anybody who drinks? Let me put it this way. Anybody here know anybody who drinks who would admit to drinking? Who would also say that they always drink responsibly? Two people. Because the conversations I've had with folks are like this. Yeah, you should drink responsibly, but you know, it's probably wrong to get drunk and drive or get buzzed and drive, but you know what? There was that one time I had a little bit too much, and we did this and we did that. Virtually, you get in a conversation with them, and every last one of them will tell you that they haven't always drunk responsibly. And again, we'll talk about that. That's another illusion, that you can drink responsibly, that you're going to do that, as if you could anyway, as if drinking is responsible. Just another lie that we're told. Our society and a lot of Christians in it, including maybe some that are sitting in this room, really need a wake-up call on the issue of drinking alcohol. We are asleep and dreaming in a fantasy land if we go about day by day in denial of the serious spiritual, physical harm that comes from alcohol. So here's drinking and driving. Yeah, bad thing. Every year nearly 10,000 people are killed, 170,000 injured due to alcohol-impaired drivers. That's a lot of hurt. That's a lot of pain. On average, every 90 seconds, someone is injured in a drunk driving crash. Most of us who've lived very long, who lived to be my age, have lost, literally lost, loved ones and friends because of those who drink and drive. I've had multiple people in my life, loved ones, people who I cared about, people who are my friends who lost their lives because somebody was drinking and driving. Alcohol not only kills people, and that's a statistic we hear about in the drinking and driving. It hurts people who aren't killed. Not everyone who gets hit by a drunk driver dies. Some of them might wish they had, like this young lady. That's a real picture of a real beautiful young woman who was in an accident caused by a drunk driver. A lot of people walk away with debilitating injuries or don't walk away at all. There are a lot of other negatives besides just those that come from automobile crashes from drinking. And those are things you're not told about. For instance, did you know that there's a connection with crime and violence? Drinking is associated directly with violent crime. A study was done just a few years ago of state prisoners who are in prison because of violent crime. So that's what they're convicted of. They're in prison because of violent crime. 37% said they were under the influence of alcohol when they committed their crime. 37%. And drinking is harmless? I don't think so. It has huge effects on the home, personal life. There's a correlation between drinking and domestic violence. If you ask a police officer how many times when you answer a domestic violence call is drinking involved, when I've asked police officers that, you know what the answer is that I've gotten? How many times when you answer a domestic violence call do you get there and there's drinking involved? You know what the answer is? Every time. It's either drinking or drugs, every time. And it's harmless? I don't think so. There's a correlation between the breakup of families. Here's an interesting study that I read. There's a direct correlation. The more you drink, the more you drink, the more likely you are to get a divorce. It's a statistical fact. You can just measure how much somebody drinks, and if they're married, here's the likelihood, the percentage goes up with however much they drink, that they're going to get a divorce. It's not harmless, is it? It's correlation between it and domestic violence, breakup of families, correlation to risky sexual behavior. Sometimes even the world will admit to this. Unintended pregnancies. I personally know young ladies who came up pregnant after a night of drinking and don't remember how. But they had children nonetheless. And I know one young lady who does not know who the father was. And we're told that drinking is harmless. There's a lack of productivity on the job, and I have personally, again, known a lot of people. When you're young, you don't believe this could ever happen to you, but once you've got a few years on you and drinking really gets a hold of you, I've known a lot of people lose their jobs because they'd show up slightly tickled in their job. Hope you see that it's not exactly harmless activity. It's a factor in a lot of diseases and deaths, causes health problems in the brain, the liver, the pancreas, can be a contributor to cancer, to problems with the immune system. I personally have lost two great uncles who drank beer all their lives and died of cirrhosis of the liver due to drinking that beer all their lives. Once in a while you hear a report, well, you know, if you drink moderately, it's really kind of good for your health. If you drink a little red wine, how many have heard that statistic? If you drink some red wine, it's good for your health. Yeah, that gets out there once in a while. And there are some things in red wine, in fact, that are healthy for you. There's, those things that help your body in a lot of different ways. But most of those things that are in red wine, and probably all of them, are also in grape juice. It doesn't have to be fermented. But besides that, in the studies that have been done about that, the truth is it's a very select group of people that are being studied. You know, people who only drink one glass of red wine a day. The reality is that people who drink, it's really hard to find a person that only drinks one glass of red wine a day, you see. So you get a very, very select group of people who are able to control their drinking in this way, and it's a very small minority, and then you come up with this statistic about them. And the reality is that drinking, in the vast majority of cases, has a tremendous negative effect on your health. I mean, a tremendous negative effect. You know, doctors will say, for instance, that hard drinkers, if they do autopsies on them, they'll have clear arteries. Sure enough, it clears out your arteries, removes all that plaque and cholesterol, but you got a liver that's twice the size it's supposed to be in disease beyond belief. It's like, you know, you got a headache and you say, wow, I really wish this pain would go away, so I'm going to do something to make me, you know, not think about this pain in my head anymore. So you shoot yourself in the foot. You know, you don't think about your pain in your head anymore, right? But now you've shot yourself in your foot. It's counterproductive to your health virtually all of the time to drink. And I think that's something, again, the Satan is trying to pull the wool over your eyes. What I want you to do is think about this reality check. And we're just talking right now about physical things. 10,000 deaths per year related to drinking and driving, directly connected to violent crime, has a negative effect on the home and personal life, negative effect on health. Don't let your reality check bounce. Don't let your reality check bounce. Don't let Satan keep that illusion in your life. Let's unmask it today. Just look at what's real about drinking. Now, all of the things I've talked about so far have to do with your physical well-being, really. But our focus here in these studies is not our physical well-being. I'm concerned with your spiritual well-being. And I'm here to tell you that alcohol will ruin your spiritual for a number of different reasons. And I want you to see in this lesson the dangers of alcohol as they're presented in Scripture. And we have to start with a few definitions. I want to talk about what the word wine means in the Bible. Wine is used in the Bible to refer to, the juice product of the grape, which could either be fermented or unfermented. Now, a lot of times by fermented, I mean it's, you know, been handled and stored in such a way that it develops an alcohol content in it. Unfermented is basically grape juice. I think most of us understand that. So in the Bible, the word wine doesn't necessarily refer to something that has alcohol in it. In fact, I can point you, and I'm going to show you just here in a second, to several references where plainly the word wine is used and it cannot be referring to that which has alcohol in it. For instance, in Isaiah 16 and verse 10, the passage talks about wine that's in the presses. Wine that's in the presses. And you have a picture here to the right of a wine press. You know how they, in old times, and even in some countries still today, when they pick the grapes, the way they get the juice out of them is they go sort of dance on top of them. And they stomp out the grapes, and then the juice sort of flows out, and that's how they collect the juice. Well, the wine that's in the press, that's a wine press. That's what that's called. It's a kind of wine press. When you first press out the juice, the wine in the wine press, is that alcoholic? Is it? No, it's not fermented yet. It's just grape juice, isn't it? So obviously in Isaiah 16:10, that's just grape juice. Isaiah 65 and verse 8 talks about wine that is found in the cluster. Well, in the cluster of a grape, of the grapes, you can't have fermented wine. You can't have alcoholic wine. That's just grape juice. It's naturally impossible. And so you have that. Mark 2 and verse 22, Jesus talks about no one puts new wine into old wineskins. Anybody can tell me why did they put new wine into a skin to begin with? Why would they put it in a animal skin? What's the purpose of that? What are they doing with it? For the purpose of fermenting it. Okay? That's the reason you put grape juice in a wineskin. And when you did that, then you sealed it up. And what would happen is, what would happen is that the sugars and the yeast would interact together and cause the wine to ferment. And in the process of that, the wine builds up some gases and it expands. So you put it in an animal skin basically so it would stretch. What Jesus is talking about is if you have new wine, you don't want to put it in an old wineskin that's already stretched out. Because once you put it in there and it starts fermenting, then that old wineskin can't stretch anymore. It's going to pop. That's basically what he's talking about. But the point is, he calls it new wine. What does he call it? Wine. And it's new wine. It can't be fermented. It's going into the wineskin to be fermented. So here's three verses where the word wine is definitely used. It can't be referring to alcoholic wine. Well, the point of this is, when you study through the Bible, both Old Testament and New Testament, you can't always tell in a given verse, just by the use of the word wine, is it alcoholic or not. Most of the time you can tell by the context. If you look around in the context, is somebody getting drunk? Is somebody becoming inebriated? Are there warnings about it? Are there problems with it? Most of the time, you know, if that kind of thing is mentioned in the context, you know it's alcoholic wine. And then other contexts, like the ones we've read, it's obvious it's not alcoholic wine. And there might be a few times when you can't tell. You have to tell by the context. By the word itself. By the word wine itself. You can't always know. But there is a word that's used in the Bible where you can know that it's talking about alcoholic wine or alcoholic drink. And it's usually translated in the Old Testament, or oftentimes it's translated by the phrase strong drink. Strong drink. Sometimes it's translated some other ways. But the Hebrew word there is a different word than the normal word for wine in the Old Testament. The Hebrew word is shikar, and it refers to alcoholic beverage which contained a max of 10% alcohol by volume. Now, the reason that we know it contained 10%, only 10%, and probably less than that, alcohol by volume, is because that's the maximum amount that the natural fermenting process will allow for alcohol to be. There's a limit because of the limitations of sugars and things like that and the fermentation process. There's a limit to how much alcohol can be produced by natural fermentation. And the upper limit of that is 10%. So when you read the phrase strong drink in the Old Testament, you're reading about a drink that could only be 10% alcohol content at most. And that's what's called strong drink. The thing about strong drink is that in the Old Testament, every time you read about it, there are three ways it's discussed. Either you can drink it for your health, you know, as like you drink NyQuil, or you can offer it as a sacrifice, or it's sinful and you better stay away from it. And those are the only three ways it's talked about in the Old Testament. Most of the time, when strong drink is referred to in the Old Testament, it's sinful and you better stay away from it. The only other two ways you can use it are either as a sacrifice or as medicine. Every other way, it's condemned. And this only has 10% alcohol. Nearly all modern alcoholic beverages would qualify as strong drink. That's the phrase that's used in Proverbs 20 and verse 1, where we're told that he who is led astray by it is not wise. Let me tell you about modern alcohol. In about the year 1800, there was a French chemist by the name of Jean-Antoine Chaptal who invented a process by which, during fermenting, you could increase the amount of alcohol that would come out of the wine. Basically, what Chaptal found was that if you added sugar to the process in the right amount and at the right time, you can increase how much alcohol comes out of the wine. So that process is called Chaptalization. Then men discovered another process by which they can just take straight alcohol and inject it into the wine to increase the alcoholic content. So between this process of Chaptalization that's invented in 1800, and the process, this other process is called fortification, where they just put alcohol in the wine. Between that, virtually all wines that are made today are between 8% and 15% alcohol content. Some are much more than that. If you've ever heard of a Zinfandel wine, it has 22% alcohol content. How much did I say was the most that strong drink could have? 10%. And I just said some wines have 22%. So here's a drink from the low of 8% to a high of 22%. Some wines have twice as much alcohol in them as strong drink, which is condemned for use, for recreational use, all throughout the Old Testament. What about other kinds of drinks that we have today? Popular beers usually have between 4 and 6% alcohol, so they'd be kind of on the lower end of strong drink in the Old Testament. Hard liquors like whiskey and tequila, vodka and rum, have 40 to 50% alcohol, and bourbon can have as much as 80% alcohol content. So virtually every kind of modern alcoholic beverage that's sold on the market today would qualify as strong drink, and some of it would be strong drink times 10, from, you know, 8% to 80%. Y'all seeing this? So what I tell people is this, and here's a concept you got to get down. We look at those Old Testament passages that say, like in Proverbs, don't even look at the wine when it's red. Be cautious, you know, don't be led astray by strong drink. It's a mocker and a brawler and a deceiver. And all of these warnings we have about strong drink, and the stuff we've got today is maybe 10 times stronger than strong drink. And somebody says, oh, it won't hurt you. Really? Does that even make any horse sense to anybody? I mean, whatsoever. And the reality is that when somebody goes back to the Bible and says, well, they drank wine in the Bible, and so it's got to be okay. It's not that big a deal. We'll talk about that maybe in a few minutes. What they're comparing is, it's not really apples to oranges. It's like, what they're comparing is cider to Jack Daniels. Okay? Because what they had in the Bible is cider, and what we got today is Jack. So it's not even a fair comparison. It's not even a fair comparison. I want you to go in your Bibles now to 1 Peter chapter 4 and verse 3, and we're going to switch gears just a little bit. Drinking alcohol is, on a social basis, is prohibited in this passage. I don't know how to say that any plainer. People say, well, where does the Bible say you can't drink? 1 Peter 4:3. That's where it says it. And here's how it says it. We've spent enough of our past lifetime in doing the will of the Gentiles when we walk in lewdness, lust, drunkenness, revelries, drinking parties, and abominable idolatries. There are three drinking-related sins that are mentioned in this context. Drunkenness, everybody knows what that is, has a legal definition in our day and time. Revelries, wild drinking parties, the frat party in college, the going out, you know, with friends after the prom, taking a keg of beer to the river, that sort of thing. Those are just drinking parties. That's what that's talking about. That's revelry, I should say. And then a drinking party, the translators have a hard time. Some of the translations say carousing or carousal here, and some say drinking party. They have a hard time bringing this word over into English, as the different translations show. But the word literally means, the Greek word literally means a drinking. Literally, it's a noun that just means a drinking, without reference to the amount that's being drunk. The Greek scholar R.C. Trench says it's not necessarily excessive, but it gives opportunity to excess. So it's like a, you know, you go to a ball game, or you sit in front of a ball game, you know, and there's some beer there, and you're drinking, and maybe nobody's really trying to get drunk, but you could get drunk. Or maybe you're just having a meal together, and so alcohol is available, and you drink one beer, and well, you want another? Yeah, okay. So it's not that you were there to get drunk, you were just having a meal, but you could get drunk by what's available. That's what we used to call social drinking. Just drinking, we call it today recreational drinking. Drinking as part of your recreation. As part of daily life. And that's what this word condemns. So where does the Bible say drinking is wrong? Is alcohol wrong for every use? No, we're going to see that it has a legitimate use still today. But as far as social drinking, recreational drinking, drinking with my buds, drinking with my meals all the time, that's prohibited by this verse, by this passage. And I could go into a lot more on the Greek word and so on and so forth. But basically this passage is just prohibiting Christians from drinking alcohol on social or recreational occasions. Another thing I want us to think about for a little bit is that drinking alcohol leads to other sins. In fact, it leads to a lot of other sins. It leads to drunkenness. Can't get drunk without drinking, right? So, you know, there's the little gauge there. Y'all see that gauge? No drinking, you're sober. Way over on the other side, you know, you're falling down drunk. Well, that's a process. You're moving the needle from being sober to being over here drunk. And, you know, a lot of things depending on how your body processes alcohol and your size and your weight and your gender and all of that sort of thing may determine how you get from sober to drunk. But it's a process. And so if I take one drink, I've moved the needle, haven't I? I'm starting this process. Does anybody remember I'll see if you can help me out here. Jesus taught us to pray. And he said, pray, lead us not, how does the rest of that go? Man, lead us not into temptation. That's what it is. Now I remember. Thanks. Now, suppose somebody says, well, I don't think drinking a little bit is really a sin. But I agree that drunkenness is a sin. And I take one drink, and what have I done? I've moved the needle toward that sin, haven't I? Toward the sin of drunkenness. And then I go and pray. Can I pray that prayer, lead me not to temptation, when I'm doing that? When I'm going smack toward the temptation, even if I say drinking's not wrong, just drunkenness is. You see what I'm saying? The drinking leads to the drunkenness. How can I say, yeah, I'm doing what Jesus said, lead me not to temptation, and I'm doing the very thing that brings me to the sin of drunkenness? That can't be right. I said, poor sense, folks, poor sense. It's just, you gotta think. Don't let Satan pull that over your eyes. You know, a lot of people say, well, I can stop in time. I'm a righteous person. And I'm not going to let that get the best of me, and I'm not going to get drunk and do something stupid. So you're more righteous than Lot, and more righteous than Noah. Is that you? You're a better person than Noah, stronger than he was. What happened to Noah? Got drunk, exposed himself in his tent, embarrassing, terrible situation. What happened to Lot? Got drunk, had relations with his own daughters, incest, terrible. Both of those men are extraordinarily righteous men, strong men. God saved the world because of one of them. I don't think we're stronger than they were. It happened to them, it happened to us. Don't let Satan trick you into thinking it can't, because it surely can't. Surely can't. Well, the New Testament teaches us not only to pray, lead us not into temptation, but also to exercise self-control. And drinking leads to a lack of self-control. This is a picture of a bottle of beer. I think that's Bud Light. The manufacturer printed this on the bottom of the bottle. Perfect beer for removing no from your vocabulary for the night. It removes your inhibitions, right? I didn't say that. They're advertising it that way. And so, you want to say no to sexual temptation, as we talked about, you know, earlier today? Is drinking going to help you do that? It's not going to help you say no. It's going to remove no from your vocabulary. In fact, it removes a lot of self-control. People do things all the time under the influence of just a little bit of alcohol, say things all the time under the influence of just a little bit of alcohol that they would not do or say had they not had that drink. Happens all the time. Satan tells you, oh, it's okay, but you're going to lose, to whatever degree you drink, you're going to lose some self-control. What's the legal limit as far as your driving? How much alcohol can you have in your system? 0.08. Okay. At what point does impairment begin to occur, where driving skills begin to fade just a little bit? Anybody know that? 0.02. And for most of us, that would be one drink. Where you can't operate a car, for instance, as well as you could if you were completely sober. Now, if 0.02 impairs my driving, what will it do for my praying? What will it do for my Bible study? What will it do for my decision-making in my interpersonal relationships with family, friends, girlfriends, and boyfriends? Is my judgment going to be as good? Is my self-control going to be what it ought to be? No way. I need to move on. In the last part of this lesson, I'd like to answer some objections that are often made when I begin to teach from 1 Peter 4:3 that drinking socially is sinful. There are those that say, well, the Bible really says it's okay to drink, doesn't it? I mean, doesn't the Bible give us a reason to think that social drinking is really all right? After all, Christ made wine at the wedding in Cana of Galilee. He turned water into wine. Everybody go over to John chapter 2. They have, Jesus is at a wedding feast with his disciples. They run out of wine. Jesus' mother comes to him and tells him about it. Jesus is going to fix the problem. He tells the servants to take six pots that were sitting there after the matter of purification and fill them up with water. Fill them to the brim, he says. And each one of those pots contained how much? What does the text say? Could contain how much liquid? 20 to 30 gallons. So there's six of them, 20 to 30, between 120 and 180 gallons. Let's say 150 gallons. So Jesus has them fill those pots all the way up, then has the servant, he never touches it, which is part of the miracle. Of course, the thing about this is a tremendous miracle that Jesus is showing his divinity. But he never touches it, never touches the pots, apparently. But he has a servant take some of the water that's now turned to wine to the master of the feast. And when he tastes it, he says, wow, it's better than what was put out to begin with. And he goes, you know, basically to the groom and he says, you know, usually they put out the good stuff first and then the inferior later after people have, what's the phrase he uses? Well drunk. In other words, people have been, whether it's alcoholic or not, I'm not talking about that right now. I don't think it is, and I'm going to tell you why in a minute. But whatever it was that they were drinking, they drunk a lot of it. Y'all follow that? In fact, they drunk so much of it, they drunk it all up. It's all gone. Someone says, well, this could have occurred, you know, wedding feast went over several days and all that sort of thing. I know that. But the point is, the master of the feast said people had well drunk. The meaning there, if you look that up, is really the idea of satiated, where, you know, you're pretty full. Like, you know, after you went through, Andrew, your second time through the line today at lunch, and had your 17th chicken finger, then, you know, after that, the 18th chicken finger probably be hard to taste whether it was better than the first 17 or not. That's basically the situation here. These people were filled with wine already. And you're telling me, with a straight face, that Jesus makes 150 more gallons of alcoholic wine and gives it to people who are already so full that they were sloshing? I don't think so. I don't think there's any reasonable argument that can be made that Jesus made alcoholic wine on this occasion. As we said, wine can be alcoholic or not. And wine, by the way, that wasn't alcoholic was considered to be very good in ancient times because it was hard to preserve. And so it was really sometimes preferred by people, what we would call grape juice. Someone says, well, Timothy was told to take wine. You know, Paul tells Timothy in 1 Timothy 5:23, take a little wine for your stomach's sake and for your oft infirmities. All right, let's look at that. How much wine was he supposed to take? A lot, right? He was supposed to drink like a ton a day, right? Is that what it says? Take a little wine. What's the purpose? Your stomach and your infirmities. What did I say earlier about grape juice? Does it help your infirmities? Good for you, isn't it? So I'm not even sure that this is alcoholic wine. It could be. But even if it is, it's how much is he to take? Just a little bit. And what's the purpose? It's medicine, isn't it? Everybody see that? I don't have a problem with taking alcohol for medicine. I've had a shot of NyQuil or two in my life myself. But that's a different story. Okay? That's for a purpose that's medicinal. And that's what Paul is prescribing for Timothy. Someone says, well, it's okay to drink as long as you don't drink too much. You look at passages like Titus chapter 2 and verse 3. The older women are not to be given to much wine. See, just don't be given to much wine. It's okay to do a little. It just says don't be given to much wine. Or Titus chapter 1 and verse 7, an elder is not to be given to wine. And here's where I need you to think with me for just a minute. If I tell you not to do a lot of something, just whatever it is, don't do a lot of illegal drugs, does that mean it's okay to do a little bit of illegal drugs? Does prohibiting a lot permit a little always? I think we can think better than that, can't we? The scriptures talk about, for instance, not going to an overflow of wickedness in James chapter 1 and verse 21. So as long as I don't overflow wickedness, if I just kind of, you know, fill wickedness up to the top but don't go over, it's okay, right? Just a little bit of wickedness is good. That's not good. So prohibiting a lot does not, prohibiting a lot does not permit a little, necessarily. It could, but you have to have other verses that tell us that. And so that kind of reasoning from Titus really doesn't wash as far as I'm concerned. Romans 14:21 is sometimes a passage that's used. Everybody turn over there. In Romans, Paul's talking about things that are allowed, but not necessarily required. What we sometimes call matters of opinion or judgment. I don't know that those are really good descriptions, but that's how we describe them sometimes. But in 14:21, he says, it's good neither to eat meat or drink wine or do anything by which your brother stumbles or is offended or is made weak. So someone says, well, see, drinking wine's just a matter of opinion. It's right here in this passage. Let me notice some things with you about this. First of all, can somebody tell me whether or not the wine here is fermented or not? How can you know in this passage if it is or not? If you think about that for a second, you realize you can't tell in this passage if the wine that's being talked about is fermented or not. Somebody says, well, why would anybody find grape juice to be objectionable? Why would anybody object to you just drinking grape juice? Well, because of this reason. The meats and the wines, both fermented and unfermented, were offered to idols in pagan cities. And there was a big deal about whether or not Christians were permitted to eat those meats and drink those wines. And so I'm not sure that the issue is that whether the wine is alcoholic here. It could be whether the wine had been offered to a pagan god or not. Whether or not it might be. And like again, the context doesn't say whether it's alcoholic or not, so you really can't tell. But the other thing I want you to notice is that Paul doesn't say it's okay to do this. He says, if it causes your brother to stumble, what? He doesn't say do it. He says, don't do it. So how do you go to a verse that says don't do it and say that it's saying it's okay to do it? See what I'm saying? Does that make any sense at all? This passage is saying don't do it. And so I don't think that's a very strong justification either, especially in light of many other passages that we might look at. Somebody else says, well, wine is just food. It's created to be received with thanksgiving, 1 Timothy chapter 4. You shouldn't make laws of men about what God has created to be received with thanksgiving. Well, I'm not making any laws of men here this afternoon. All the laws that I've read are from God's book. 1 Peter 4:3 is in God's book. What we saw in Proverbs 20 and many other passages, both Old and New Testament, about the dangers of drinking alcohol, all that's in God's book. But just because something is created by God, and first of all, wine, alcoholic beverages are not created by God. They're all created by men. God gave us the ingredients and the processes, but men have to fiddle with it to make alcoholic drink. Y'all realize that. There is no naturally occurring alcoholic beverage. So it's not really just like food. It's food that's been messed with by men. But besides that, if it's a natural food and God created foods to be received with thanksgiving, does that mean I can have all I want anytime I want? Is that what that means? No restrictions on it, right? Because it's a natural food. So for instance, the seeds of poppies, are those natural? seeds of poppies. Natural food, right? So I can have all that I want. God never said not to. There's nothing in the Bible about that. I saw all kinds of verses about drinking, alcohol and stuff, but what about poppy seeds? Anything in that? So I can have all I want, right? Just food. I hope everybody realizes that that's the main ingredient of opium, and maybe in some other drugs as well, but it's, you won't pass a drug test. Good point. You won't pass a drug test if you eat all the poppy seeds you want. I thank you for your kind attention this afternoon and for your kind attention throughout all of this series. You've been great. I know it's kind of a marathon and it's hard to stay focused for this long. I'm going to tell you a story about a young man who sat exactly where you're sitting in this church. His parents, godly parents, they never had alcohol in their home. They taught him from the time he was a little boy that it was wrong to drink alcohol. He grew up, went away from home, had a study with a preacher one time who was wrong about this subject, and the preacher told him, you know, it's okay to drink once in a while. It's not really a sin. The Bible allows it. So he started drinking once in a while. At first it would just be at home, and then later he would go out with buddies from work and drink. And before long, he was drinking quite a bit and not coming home after work and going out every night and drinking. Eventually his behavior led him to lose a lot of his inhibitions, make choices he otherwise wouldn't have made, engage in gambling, sexual immorality, and perversion of the very worst kind. Lost his wife, lost his two children in divorce. March 8th of this year, call my house, because he's my son. And he said, Dad, I'm in jail. And he and his girlfriend had been drinking. They got into a fight, and he got shot. I talked with him a couple weeks after that, and he said to me, got to stop drinking because I lose control. Take about 5 minutes. Thank you.